mercy of the carpet bag. What you call justice is plain unfair. How the hell can you ever claim it's been worth all the pain just to have us live together under one flag? They laid waste.
On November 15th, 1864, General Sherman cut out the back of Atlanta with 68,000 hard-worn Yankees. He drove them down through Georgia to the sea. With hate in their hearts, they moved in a line, cutting a scar through God's blessed country, 50 miles wide. Burning, looting, gutting our land like vultures. They tore up the railroad tracks. They burnt the cotton and the gin. Lord, they made everybody suffer.
Ain't it enough just to know that you got us
of this is man's bullshit. They call this war a cloud over the land, but they made the weather, and then they stand in the rain and say, shit, it's raining!
Well, there we go. That's the start from White Mansions. You can go on up to YouTube and get that White Mansions. That's a great album about the Civil War. And, of course, that last clip comes from the movie Cold Mountain. Yeah. Well, as far as I'm concerned, knowing quite a bit about the Civil War, there were really no heroes. The guys that died fought with bravery on both sides, but really, once you're into a battle situation, you're simply trying to save your own life. You're not thinking much about being a hero for anybody. And of course, the political leaders at the time were all involved in what I would call criminal warfare. And it didn't have to happen. So today we've been asked to run a repeat on the reasons for and why it shouldn't have never been the Civil War. As with most wars. Well, in case you're interested, before I start with the latest sports news, Belgium just recently whipped Israel in football. How about that? And Freya's Day here at P.O. Box 401, Warsaw, Indiana, 46581. It was very, very foggy last night. I'm glad I didn't go anyplace. Yeah. Get your donations in for the radio show and donations for any other project like our POWs. And they're very appreciative, and they tell me all the time how appreciative they are to get a little money in there because almost nobody else ever sends them any money. That's interesting how that works, you know. Even blacks, prisoners, and some of them have done some really bad stuff, but they get support. The family support them. Their friends support them. They get money. And white prisoners, white POWs, get almost nothing from the right wing. Don't forget it. I remember that William Pierce of the National Alliance never sent any money into POWs. Only one, later on, Richard Scutari. Other than that, he never sent, he said he didn't send money to POWs. And that was when National Alliance had a lot of money. The Civil War was a result of a series of political crimes and blunders of which both sections of the country were equally guilty. It was not inevitable or necessary to fight in order to abolish slavery. In every other country in the world, slavery had been abolished without war. The question of slavery had never been a party issue until after the Mexican War, but from then until the election of 1860, slavery was the leading political issue. During the war with Mexico, Wilmot of Pennsylvania offered what is known as a Wilmot Proviso, which provided that the territory acquired from Mexico should be closed to slavery. Although this bill was defeated in Congress, it brought up the question of further extension of slavery. At the time of the Mexican War, there were two national parties, the Whigs and the Democrats. These two parties embraced almost all the people, and as both were strong in both sections of the United States, they tended to cement the union, for parties on a national basis tend to unify a nation, while the sectional parties led to disunion. The anti-slavery people and the moderates gravitated towards the Whig Party, while the pro-slavery people gravitated towards the Democratic Party. The Whigs elected General Zachary Taylor president in 1848. Although he was a large slaveholder in Louisiana, he was a moderate and was satisfactory to all the groups and sections. He had the support of Lincoln as well as of the Southern Whigs. Soon after Taylor became president, Henry Clay proposed the famous Compromise of 1850, the important features of which were to admit California as a free state, organize the remainder of the territory taken from Mexico without regard to slavery, abolish the slave trade in the District of Columbia, and pass a fugitive slave law to be enforced by the federal government. This compromise, although a Whig measure, was instrumental in killing the Whig Party. No party or section was satisfied with it. President Taylor opposed it, but his death before its passage brought to the presidency the vice president, Fillmore, who allowed it to become law without his signature. The provision that broke up the Whig Party was the strict fugitive slave law, and anti-slavery Whigs repudiated their party. The idea of returning fugitive slaves was shocking to the best moral judgment of the time. The leaders of moral sentiment, ministers, poets, and reformers of every type, advised disobedience. It was a dead letter because of the moral sentiment of the age was against it. On the other hand, the pro-slavery people did not like it because it was not enforced. Thus, the law was treated with contempt by both parties. The Whig Party, which was moderate, national, opposed to expansion and the extension of slavery, was disrupted. The Democrats carried all except four states in 1852 and remained in power until 1860. Dominated by powerful pro-slavery sentiment throughout this period. After the fall of the Whig Party, the Republican Party was organized in 1856. It took the name Republican from the followers of Thomas Jefferson and claimed it was a rival of the party of Jefferson. A revival. Yeah, but remember, Jefferson was a slave owner. He had about 200 slaves. He only released one, gave that one freedom, and that was on his deathbed. So much for that. It was the Liberal Party opposed to slavery. It was organized until after Civil War, dominated by the liberal element in the United States. The Democratic Party was claimed themselves to be followers of Jefferson, which they were not at that time, except in a very narrow legal sense. Jefferson was opposed to slavery and special privilege in any form. In 1800, he advocated states' rights or a decentralized government because he believed the states were and would always be more popularly controlled than the federal government. But by 1860, that situation was reversed. The states, especially the southern states, had begun to be dominated by the privileged group. That's the those days capitalists who talked in terms of states' rights to perpetuate this privilege, while Jefferson talked in terms of states' rights because he feared the domination of the federal government by a reactionary element. Both Lincoln and Jefferson held the same views socially. The Democratic Party of the Civil War period had repudiated Jefferson, but the Republican Party did not become reactionary until after the Civil War. When the Republican Party was organized in 1856, it was regarded as a red chiefly in the eyes of the South, for it was organized principally with the idea of keeping slavery out of the West. Its campaign literature of 1856 was composed largely of the anti-slavery utterances of Jefferson. To the South, Republican, Anarchy, abolitionist, Lincoln, John Brown, and Garrison were soon to become synonymous terms. Because of this, the Republican Party had no following in the South. even among great many people who wished to abolish slavery. It became a sectional party, which was its fatal weakness in dealing with slavery, as compared with the former Whig Party, which had a national following. The Republican Party was sectional before 1860. Lincoln had been a Whig. He had accepted the Compromise of 1850, although he was one of the great men of all times. Well, I disagree with that. He was a victim of many of the common errors of his age. Reflecting the belief of his time, he considered slavery a stable institution, so he vacillated quite a bit. His great democratic spirit lay in the fact that he expressed the ideas of the common man and had complete faith in him. Well, I think that's a mistake myself. If you look around today and if you have faith in the common man, I worry about you. He tried to recognize and give expression to the purposes and aspirations of the masses, which made him one of the world's greatest Democrats, with democracy's strength and weaknesses, mostly weaknesses. Lincoln was not a creative thinker and had few pretensions in that direction. He had no intention of abolishing slavery in the states. He simply wished to prevent it from spreading. He also held the common attitude of his age that the Negro belonged to an inferior race. In the election of 1860, Lincoln polled only 26,430 votes in the entire South, and those were from the upper section. Douglas, the moderate Democrat, received 163,525 votes in the South. Bell of the Unionist Party received 515,973 votes in the same section, while Breckinridge, the extreme pro-slavery candidate, received 570,871 votes in the entire South. Breckinridge carried the lower South by a plurality, while Lincoln carried the West and the North by a plurality, and was elected president. The Douglas and Bell voters of the South were opposed to secession, but all the secession vote went to Breckinridge, although not all Breckinridge vote was for secession. A majority in the South opposed secession, but the Southern states fell into the hands of the secessionists by a plurality. Why did the South secede? Lincoln was elected on a platform of defying Dred Scott decision of 1857. According to this decision, the Constitution recognized slavery, and therefore Congress could not prohibit it in the Western territories. This could be done only by the states through their constitutions, or by the federal government through a constitutional amendment. This was a great legal victory for slavery, but Lincoln defied the decision and expected the next move on the part of the pro-slavery advocates to an attempt to legalize slavery in the northern states through a Supreme Court decision. Yeah, I want to remind you of something, that there actually was a secessionist movement started first in New York State. In New York City, wanted to secede from the Union. That was quite a while before the actual secession of the South. Lincoln, when asked what he meant by saying the Union could not exist half free and half slave, said that slavery would eventually have to go, but it would probably be at least 100 years. Well, he should have said the Negroes have to go all the way out, which he did not do. He did not realize that slavery was dying. This election of Lincoln on a platform defying a decision of the Supreme Court caused the lower court to secede. As a gesture to uphold the courts and the Constitution, Lincoln coerced them in order to uphold the Constitution, but he had been legally elected president and his office required his execution of federal laws. Thus, both the North and the South fought to defend the Constitution. Well, personally, I say a federalized Constitution was dead in the water before it even got off the ground. I mean, it continued on to become empire. Thus, both North and the South fought to defend the Constitution. Sorry, boys, I'm a bit cynical on that stuff. Both felt themselves defensive. Neither section understood the other, and emotionalism in the matter was so kindled that reason could not function on either side. Well, of course, they spread fear, too. The radicals in the North and the South all spread fear that they're going to get you. The Civil War was a war about an abstraction, the status of slavery in the Western Territory, which was the real cause of the war. There were other differences between the North and the South, but none of them would have resulted in a war had not the slave question entered into the conflict. By 1860, slavery was in greater part of the civilized world was a dead or dying institution. And a lot of that had to do with the invention of the cotton gin technology. Great Britain in 1833 abolished slavery and all her possessions. Mexico provided for the gradual abolition of Mexico as early as 1827. Brazil followed in 1888, and Spain abolished slavery in Cuba in 1878. In all these cases, it was done without conflict. All the northern states of the Union had become free, and the western states and the territories were repudiating slavery as well. When California drew up her constitution and asked for admission in 1850, the clause prohibiting slavery was adopted by a unanimous vote of her constitutional convention. In the referendum held in Kansas in 1858, 11,300 out of a total vote of 13,088 were opposed to slavery. Only a few slaves had been carried there, and they could never have been permanently held as slaves. New Mexico was organized as a territory in 1850 without regard to slavery, and at one time as many as 22 slave states had carried there. Nevada, Colorado, and Dakota were organized as territories before 1860 but had no slaves. In Missouri, slavery was on the decrease. If judged by its percentage of the entire population, in 1830, 17.8% of the Missouri population were slaves. In 1840, 15.5%. In 1850, 12.8%. And in 1860, only 9.8%. Slavery would have existed in Missouri only for a few more years, for the anti-slavery population was increasing rapidly by settlers from free states and great numbers of people from Germany who had settled in the neighborhood of St. Louis and were especially opposed to slavery. And like I told you, that exodus from Europe and Germany came from the great civil war that took place there in the 1850s. And the people who lost in that war came running to the United States to get out of there. Before 1860, slavery was non-existent in all the sections of the Union except the tobacco, cotton, and sugarcane belts. In upholding the institution of slavery, the South was opposed to the spirit of the age. Slavery was doomed by moral and economic pressure. It was a useless procedure for the South to demand the right to carry slavery into the Western Territory because it was unprofitable, uneconomical, and was not wanted. For the same reason, it was futile for the opponents of slavery to try to prohibit by law its expansion westward. The Westerners had no desire or use for it. They didn't want their states flooded with Negroes. It's pure and simple. They use the cotton and all that as an excuse, but these new states didn't want their state full of Negroes. It was this contention over slavery in Western Territory which was the abstraction over which the Civil War was fought. Many people before 1860 saw the folly of this controversy. Governor Robert J. Walker of Mississippi recognized that the West would never be open to slavery, as did Stanton of Tennessee and Senator Toombs of Georgia. The status of slavery in the West had been automatically settled by the law of nature. The two sections, however, cherished perverted ideas of each other. It was reported and actually believed in the North that Senator Robert Toombs of Georgia had boastfully declared that he would call the rule of his slaves in Massachusetts. In other words, spreading the fear factor. We're going to move our niggers to Massachusetts. these are things that even truthful people sometimes don't put it all out there. You know, they're scared to. Peer pressure. But Terrible Tommy doesn't have peer pressure. Never did, never will. The following incidents given in Macy's Political Parties in the United States, page 209 to 211, are illustrative of the state of public excitement preceding the Civil War. In an effort to dictate the slave policy of the West, Charles B. Lyons, a deacon in the New Haven congregation, which means about as much to me as a man who wants a 10-cent cup of coffee, I don't think preachers should ever be given any more respect than the education they may have that is not religious. I would not ever vote for a person, a preacher or minister, anything like that, simply because he's a preacher or minister. If he was also educated in the arts and everything, science and everything else, that's one thing. But never just a preacher. They should have more standing than, not as much standing as a local gasoline attendant at the gas station. A deacon of the New Haven congregation had enlisted a company of 29 immigrants for the war. A meeting was held in the church shortly before their departure for the purpose of raising funds, at which many clergymen and members of the Yale College faculty were present. Now remember, all these colleges were founded by churches back then. The leaders of the party announced that Sharp's rifles were lacking and they were needed for self-defense. Now here's all these so-called Christians. This is before the war started. We're already out there messing around getting the guns for the war. If they went by what they preach, they wouldn't have been doing that. But when have the Christians ever practiced what they preach? Right now you've got millions of fundamentalist Christians all hot to bomb Iran. They still want to do it, and they're going to do everything they can to put a monkey wrench into this deal that's been made just yesterday. I don't think it'll last because all these congressmen, so many of them, are beholding to the fundamentalist Zionist Christians. After an earnest address from Henry Ward Beecher, the subscription began. I remember that name, Harriet Ward Beecher Stowe, that wrote Uncle Tom's Cabin. Well, that was her husband, Henry Ward Beecher. Professor Silliman started the subscription with one Sharp's rifle. In other words, these churches were all, for the North at the time, were all passing around subscriptions for rifles and everything else to get ready for the war, and it hadn't even started yet. The pastor of the church gave the second. 50 was the number wanted. Then Beecher announced that if 25 were pledged on the spot, Plymouth Church would furnish the rest. The churches in both sections had by that time become agencies for propagating hatred. Well, they still do. Another incident is a southern one. Colonel Buford of Alabama sold a number of his slaves valued at $20,000 and invested the money to equip a troop of 300 soldiers to fight for the Southern rights in Kansas. The day that Buford's battalion started from Montgomery, they marched to the Baptist Church. The Methodist minister solemnly invoked the divine blessing on the enterprise. You see there? The Baptist minister gave Buford a finely bound Bible and said that a subscription had been raised to present each immigrant with a copy of the Holy Scripture. Now here's people that are just barely into the country and they're getting involved in a potential war. And the preacher should have, when the battalion showed up, should have said, "This is not what Jesus says. Go back home and we don't want to have a war." This battalion left for the West armed with Bibles and Sharp's rifles. That figures. One of the most violent books that ever printed, the Bible. The existence of such a condition of excitement made it an easy matter to precipitate war. In political contests, the natural tendency is for persons of extreme views to gain leadership. Well, you see that right now in the Republican Party, the war hawks. You know, with McCain and all those guys. Decided and partisan convictions are easily described and understood, whereas people of moderate and discreet judgment often lack conviction themselves and so cannot very well impress their views upon the masses. In other words, peaceful people that are not peaceful enough. Garrison's extreme abuse of the South was met there with similar other extremes. The abolitionists had great sympathy for the oppressed, but great hatred for the oppressor, and regarded the slave owner as personally responsible for slavery rather than an agent of circumstances. What do you mean, circumstances? An agent of greed in the banks. Perhaps if the abolitionists had directed their appeal to the moral conscience of the South, avoiding sectional and personal abuse, secession would never have taken place. The South met this abuse by demanding that all anti-slavery publications be excluded from the mails. So on both sides, they're the typical, like right-wing propagandists are getting people all ready for the war, getting them all hyped up, getting all fearful, and one side calling the other names and back and forth. We've got them on the radio and TV today, those same people. Only they have more influence today than they did back then. Books, papers, and all publications suspected of containing anti-slavery propaganda were taken from the mails and publicly burnt at Charleston, South Carolina, which, of course, was wrong. There were many manifestations of disregard for the sanctity of the mails. The North judged the South by these extreme actions, sort of like they did Hitler when the contingency of his Hitler Youth, I believe, took all those books out of the library and burnt them. But that's not as bad as Truman, because the books that the Germans burnt could be replaced. But Harry Truman, in pursuing World War II, ordered that all the plates, and there's certain dates to it, all the plates that hadn't been used for a while be brought together and melted down to make bullets to kill Germans and Japanese. So Truman did more in book burning and cutting off free speech than Hitler ever did, at least at that time. The North judged the South by these extreme actions, and the efforts of the South to suppress anti-slavery agitation resulted only in greater propaganda for the abolitionists. The public is quick to demand war, but it is not so willing to accept its hardships. Yeah. During the conflict, it was necessary for both North and South to suspend civil liberties. That's the first thing that goes in war. Civil rights, civil liberties, including freedom of the press and speech. Expressions that might weaken war morale were punished. Both sections suspended the writ of habeas corpus and arbitrarily imprisoned their citizens. About 38,000 people were imprisoned in the South, while the number in the South, 38,000 people were imprisoned in the North, while the number in the South was unknown. A lot of those people that were jailed in the North were because at that time you could buy your way out of going to war if you were a rich person or upper middle class or whatever. I think it was $1,500 and you wouldn't have to go to war, but all the poor people who didn't have that money were drafted in. And so a lot of those people that still refused to go were thrown in prison. And they openly said in New York City in the draft riots, they said, "We're not going to go fight for niggers." About 38,000 people were imprisoned in the North. Okay, both sections, as in all major wars, resorted to the draft to recruit soldiers. That's what we need today. If they're going to have war, they have to have a draft. But they will, in this day and age, they're not going to adopt a draft in this country, because their war plans would fall apart if they did. Yet with all these weapons at their disposal, the Northern Army succeeded in enlisting only about 1,325,000 of its native white population out of a total of 23 million, besides approximately 1,325,000 native whites. The Northern Army consisted of 300,000 whites from the South, 186,000 Negroes, and 500,000 foreigners. Left to the voluntary support of its citizens, neither action could have carried the war, as no major war of modern times could have been fought with that volunteer support alone. And that's what's going to kill the empire here, the so-called volunteer support. As it gets more brutal and more brutal, people are just not going to join up. And the only reason a hell of a lot of them join up now is simply to get a job and get some promise of going to college, because they can't find jobs. And you think that's not all planned out? They ship the jobs out to China and ship them out all over the world, so you have no jobs. And so the guys, you know, military-industrial complex wants to go to war, wants to occupy a country. It's easy for them to get guys to go. It's a sick bunch of bastards. The draft acts of both sections allowed for the employment of substitutes, which, of course, was hard on the poorer classes who could not employ substitutes. But the richer classes often avoided Army service by this method. It is impossible to obtain an exact figure of the number of substitutes employed, but the Secretary of War under Davis considered 50,000 a low estimate for the Confederate Army. See, in other words, that bought their way out of fighting in the war, in the South, too. Desertion was frequent on both sides. In this movie, Cold Mountain, you got to watch that movie, Cold Mountain. There were groups working for the Union that went around like packs of militia capturing people who had fled from the army and didn't want to fight. Desertion. Rhodes admits that the number of deserters in the South at 100,000 in 1864. And these guys that went out looking for them, these scallywags or whatever you want to call them, they were paid to bring them in. A lot of those guys got killed too. Much has been heard of the heroism and sacrifice displayed during the conflict, but little of the crimes committed by both sections. Only the pleasant phases of the war have survived. When Joseph Holt and Robert Dale Owens were appointed by Secretary of War Stanton to adjust claims for materials supplied to the War Department, they found fraud at every turn, and before making their final report in July 1862, secured deductions of nearly $17 million from claims amounting to $50 million. See, that's the other problem with war, is absolute corruption reaches its highest point in war. You know, similar to that, remember the $1 billion that was all baled up like cotton, and it was in a warehouse in Brooklyn, and then they took it by plane, I believe it was plane, probably a pregnant guppy, over there to Iraq, dumped it out. It was sitting in a vacant lot, and it just disappeared. $1 billion in paper money. And nobody talks about it anymore. One claim alone was reduced by $1 million. Another was reduced by $580,000. One senator had received $10,000 for securing an order from the War Department for a client, Colonel Henry S. Alcott, who was appointed special commissioner to investigate frauds. After a thorough examination of the facts, announced that from 20% to 25% of the expenditures of the federal treasury during the Civil War was tainted with fraud, and according to his testament, approximately $700 million was paid through fraud. This book gives you footnotes where there's other books you can track all this stuff. In commenting upon the moral conditions during the conflict, the Springfield Republican said editorially, quote, "It is a sad and shocking picture of life in Washington, which our correspondents are giving us. A Bureau of the Treasury Department made a home of seduction and prostitution. The necessities of the poor and pretty women made the means of their debauchery by the high government officials, members of Congress, putting their mistresses into clerkships in the departments, whiskey drinking ad libitum." These are some of the typical incidents of the condition in both sections, but textbooks in treating of this war, as of all the others, present only those faces which glorify the war. The cost of the Civil War, including the expenditures on both sections, pensions, destruction of property, and other indirect expenses, was $12 billion. And that's when, back when $12 billion was $12 billion. Its damages to the moral and spiritual development of the United States cannot be estimated. Well, and that's the end of that. And they can't be estimated yet because it's still going on. I mean, it's still going on. The Civil War still afflicts us. We never got rid of the problem of slavery, but we never got rid of the Negro that slave. What were they thinking? Now, I've got another book I'm going to get into next week of a man who's a real hero in the South that was trying to get legislation to move all these Negroes out of the country. Lincoln did do one thing. I don't know whether it was for just a show or not, but he was trying to make a deal with Nicaragua to move hundreds of thousands of Negroes down there. But at first, in fact, they appropriated $250,000 for it. But Nicaragua thought it over for a few days or a few weeks and got back to Washington and said, "No, we don't want your niggers." Okay, that's the end of that. We'll get into some more areas of the Civil War as time goes on. And just remember what Benjamin Franklin was quoted as saying, "There never was a good war nor a bad peace," and especially how it screwed the white race, I'll tell you that. And if it came to these rats in Washington today and how I feel about them and how I hate them and their institutions, it would make lynching a Negro way, way, way down the list, if at all. Believe me, proximity is the problem with the black. It's proximity leads to miscegenation and so forth. But the other stuff is the corruption and treason in all the areas of our government, in all the areas of this empire. And it's got to go. Well, now let's go to a piece that's been written for us by one of my old friends and compadres, comrade. I'm not going to tell you who it is because he's deep cover and he's protected my life on several occasions and did a good job of it. And that's about all I'm going to say. T.T., by the way, I saw your interview with the German-speaking mulatto woman on Russian TV last week. If you haven't seen it, your interview was the first of four. In your dissertation, you basically made her look like a dork, and they spent the rest of the 1.5 hour trying to correct that in typical Jew fashion by propping up the biggest morons and turncoats they could find. Russian TV is better than NBC, but still awfully anti-white. Yes, I know. The documentary, following the news after yours was on forced adoption in the UK, these victims of this government program is snatching children from their parents' arms, are 90% below the poverty line in almost all cases. Almost all cases white. The reason the children were taken was extremely vague. They did not mention the exact reasons, perhaps for legal reasons, but the families depicted were all white, decent-looking people. Drugs or crime did not appear to be a factor. Remembering the trials and tribulations of the Heath Campbell of New Jersey, who had his children snatched away simply for naming his children after Nazi party members, made my Jew alarm go off. Don't forget, in Heath's case, the state of New Jersey said parental rights of a Nazi dad were properly severed. Although there was no abuse or hardship inflicted on the children, and in fact they lived in a clean and orderly environment with no evident dysfunction. Let's see here. Or perhaps remember the case of the Winnipeg Canadian father and his wife, who were accused of teaching their children racist beliefs and snatched their 2-year-old son and their 7-year-old daughter from school. A little more research playing Where's the Jew revealed UK Judge Alan Goldsack praised the policy and called for the UK to forcibly remove children from criminal families at birth and placing them for adoption. I'm quite sure criminal is a euphemism meaning white nationalist or racist. The children were to be placed in prominent upper middle class homes, Jew or Shabbos Goy. In your interview with RT, you made a very interesting point about non-whites hijacking superior genetics. Jews have always done this. Their inbred stump of a family tree would have long since perished if they had not. Back to Where's the Jew? A little more digging reveals former conservative MP Michael Gove, the biggest proponent of this horrible directive, whose appearance is not a Jew, but a weenie whitey who claims to be a devout Presbyterian. Turning out he is married to a Jewish Sarah Vine, a columnist for the Jew Rag Daily Mail. He is the foremost proponent of this Jewish directive and incidentally the former education secretary. UK law states that they are putting the child's interests first. While there are financial incentives for local authorities to secure adoption due to increased funding for social service units, there is a prize for separating a white family. My research goes way beyond this short letter, Tom, and I know you're a busy man. This is a subject that needs to be reminded to white mothers, as if we cannot teach our children our plight, we are truly lost. You have a bigger voice than me out there on the perimeter, and I urge you to remind these mothers to be mindful and alert. Let us never forget the communist Jew Ila Ehrenberg's directive in a leaflet to the Red Army as they sat on the Oder River about to take Berlin. Kill, kill, kill. Stamp out the beast in his lair. Use force and take pride of the German women. Take them as your lawful booty. Kill as you storm onward. Kill. Of course, after the war, Ehrenberg said she did not recall giving that directive. Quote, I gave lots of directives, he said in an interview with Cornelius Ryan, also a Jew, in a 1965 interview. Evidently, the directive stands. Sign your buddy. Well, here's another note from one of our associates, our friends. T.T., well, tomorrow is She-Wolf Day, but perhaps Saturn's Day you could play War Pigs by Black Sabbath. Great show today, Tom. This genetically modified food thing is some heavy-duty bad shit for our race, and virtually no one on the right even flirts with digging up the information. I estimate that a good part of the listeners who at one time depended on the decrepit right wing for their information have never really heard the scoop on the environment GMOs, Wall Street banksters, and so on. So your show is a vital part of the deprogramming and re-education phase of completely and totally getting away from the old beat-down right wing. Thanks. Have a nice weekend. Lone Wolf. Well, thank you. I appreciate that. You know, I'm beginning to think the progressives and the neocons should change labels, because as far as the environment, banking, there we go, I did the same, well, I'm sorry about that automatic talk to print was on, and whenever I do that, it can screw me up, and I forget sometimes to turn it off. Anyhow, the progressives and the neocons should trade labels, at least partially. Look at it this way. There are no more conservatives around. There used to be conservatives back in the 60s and before that. But there's no conservatives around. These are neocons. And they're not trying to conserve anything. They're not trying to conserve the environment. They're not trying to conserve the air. They're not trying to conserve things that the white race has to have to survive properly. Now, on the other hand, the progressives, who we can't stand because of their racial views and some of their views on homosexuality and things like that, but we can stand them on their resistance to predatory capitalism and nailing a thing to the wall, and on the environment, on the banking, on war, and a whole bunch of issues. We can see the progressives' point, or I can, much more than the neocon, the so-called conservatives. Even the regular fake conservatives that are running around now. So we have to pick and choose. But on the other hand, like I'm saying, the neocons are not trying to conserve anything. They're destroying everything. Everywhere they go, they destroy through the predatory capitalists, military occupation, destroying the natural resources, not giving a shit about it. Whereas on the other side, like I say, you've got the progressives. Now, of course, not all of them, because some of them are just as phony as the neocons, of course. But there's a lot of good ones out there that are, you know, they're into the anti-predatory capitalism. They're for the environment and all of those things that I agree with. But we don't agree on the race and racial separation. I can't see why, because natural selection and evolution have to be tied directly to discrimination and so forth and separation. Anyhow, that's a position I think we've got on that, but it makes it a little difficult because a lot of information I like to get comes from people who, on the race issue, I can't stand. But the answer is simple to this. I can't stand anything the neocons do. I can't think of anything that they're really, that's decent, they're trying to conserve. So anyhow, that's my thought for today. What do you think about that? I think when the shit hits the fan, of course, a lot of these progressives are going to learn real fast about race. I mean, when things really go down and thousands and thousands of marauding non-whites are careening through the streets, I think they'll get their mind right pretty fast. You know, white separatism has traditionally been more left than right. If you go back through the history of the country and the various farmer movements and all that kind of stuff, the Grange and everything, it's been white people. And some of the great champions of the labor movement have been white. And somewhere along the line, we got off the track. The right wing, the leaders of the racial right should have recognized this decades ago. Now, if you go back and listen to my stuff, I've been talking like this for 20 years. But no one wants to pick up on it. And, of course, the right wing hates it. If they don't come up with an idea, then the idea is no good. And it's easier just to keep, like a parrot, repeating the same old stuff, you know. Choo, 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 nigger, 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 you know. Homo, 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 homo. There's more to this struggle than just those issues being talked about every day, 24 hours a day. Well, there's a guy on the internet, or on TV too, Neil deGrasse Tyson, who happens to be black. Boy, did he get cussed out for telling the truth. He redid the Pledge of Allegiance. Quote, if the Pledge of Allegiance told the truth, quote, I pledge allegiance to the flag of the divided states of America, and to the pacts for which it stands, one nation at odds, divisible, with liberty and justice for some. I gotta hand it to him. That hits it on the head. And he got thousands of anti-him tweets. So, you know, the truth always hurts. And you always get reaction when you tell the truth. And he was black. He is black. I guess he's going to remain black. Recently, Karl Rove got his feet put to the fire. He's a war criminal, too. He's one of George Bush Jr.'s butt buddies. A pudgy guy with soft, pudgy white hands. Well, he was cornered by an Iraqi veteran and read the Riot Act. I'm not going to play this because the sound is not that good. But this Iraqi veteran stood up and really reamed him for the aggressive war and all the people killed, and did he apologize for it? To which Karl Rove gave a ridiculous answer and essentially said, no, he's not going to apologize for it. Of course, he didn't have to go to war. Maybe none of his, if he'd got kids, they didn't go to war. And that's the way it goes. But you can't, these guys will not say yes or no. They just try to drown you with a bunch of bullshit. Karl Rove, another war criminal. You know, Walkerton, Indiana is not too far from where I'm at. And there's a pizza parlor down there. And the people who own it said that they reserve the right to not serve homosexuals and so forth. So their reason is religion. I don't care about that. But my position is more extreme. I believe that people should be free to discriminate about anything. That's the way the country was founded. And if you don't want a black person in your restaurant or bar, you should have the privilege of saying no. And no argument about it. And if you go into a black bar or a black restaurant and you're white and they don't want any whites in there, you have every reason for people to throw you out. That's where I come from. That's freedom. And even though what these people are doing is trying to promote a sort of a wacky reason, but it shouldn't make any difference about your wacky reason. If you own the pizza parlor and you don't want homosexuals to be customers, well, don't let them in. Of course, you know most of this is storming a teapot, because 99% of all businessmen are going to want money no matter how they get it, and they let a three-armed freak from Mars buy their pizza if they knew where they're going to make money off of it.
She says she has nothing against gays. She just draws the line at catering gay weddings. And for that, Indiana pizza shop owner Crystal and Kevin O'Connor had to go into hiding. And that shop, well, it looks like it could be closing, because this family has gotten so many death threats and nasty emails and tweets that Crystal's at the point where she wonders if it's even worth the trouble. To the woman many say has become the face of religious freedom in this country, but a woman who insists she bears no ill will toward gays in this country at all. No matter, Indiana's new Religious Freedom Restoration Act has galvanized the mainstream media and a whole lot of businesses against her state, and Crystal feels against her. Now, you've heard all the others thumping their chest. Now time to hear Crystal, who wants to get something off of hers. Crystal, welcome. How are you doing?
I'm doing all right.
Are you surprised all of this happened?
Yes, actually shocked.
Now, bring me back a little bit, if you can help me, Crystal, because you were talking to this local reporter at first, not about the law in the state. This reporter just dug up an interview she had done prior in which you expressed this reservation about catering a gay wedding. Tell me what happened.
Well, I was working that night at Memories Pizza, and this reporter had called and asked if she could interview us, and I was hesitant at first, and my dad said he wasn't there. He said, well, go ahead, we'll do it. And so I said, okay, and I was very nervous. And she came, and she brought up the bill and started asking questions.
And one of the questions was how you felt about gays and whether what?
I can't remember all the questions, actually. This bill would affect our business, what we thought of it, and that's how that question came across about catering for gays.
Right, and I just should explain the timeline here to folks who aren't familiar. The bill went on to become the law, signed by the governor. That reporter dug up that interview again to go back and replay it again, and then all the threats start happening, all the nastiness start happening. The irony here, though, Crystal, and correct me if I'm wrong, but you and your dad have nothing against gays. On religious grounds, you just said you couldn't cater a gay wedding. Do I have the gist of that right?
Right. They are welcome in the store. Anyone is welcome in the store. But it's against our belief to condone, to cater to their wedding. We're condoning that if we do that, and that is against our religion.
I got you.
That's
how
against
is that
our faith.
I'm sorry, Crystal. Then how is that different? Because a lot of gay rights groups and the rest have said, how is that at all different from serving gay customers and then officiating or catering their wedding?
I'm not sure what you're asking.
Well, they say you have to be consistent. They're saying you're not being consistent. You say you're happy to serve gays in your restaurant, as is your dad, but you draw the line at catering a gay wedding. They said you can't be either or. You have to be open to both or closed to both.
It is not a sin that we bring gays into our establishment and just serve them. It is a sin, though, if we cater their wedding, that we feel we are participating. We are putting a stamp of approval on their wedding, and we cannot do that.
I understand that. Crystal, there are a lot of people going to look at that and say, well, that's just being discriminating, that you're showing discrimination. You say what?
It's not at all hateful. We show no hatred towards them. We ask that they respect, as we have to allow the way they believe, we just ask that they respect the way we believe.
Well, they've not responded in kind. In fact, they've not been kind to you or your dad or with the shop. And I'm wondering, do you plan to open anytime soon, or do you think it's just not worth it? There's too much grief, too many threats, too much nastiness, it's just not worth it.
No, we have decided that we will reopen again.
When?
When? We're not sure. I mean, I'm still shaken over this, and I'll be the one that's serving the customers and answering phones, and I'm not ready to face that yet, but it will be soon.
Were you surprised that you got a lot of outrage, but the outrage garnered a lot of support? You were getting contributions on now totaling over $200,000 from sympathetic folks who felt that you were being maligned and they wanted to help you out. What did you think of that?
We are very thankful. And we're not doing it. We never did. It was never about the money. It was for our belief. And it's a blessing. And God has blessed us for standing up for what we believe and not denying Him. And
you know, it's a lot to go through, and only become the epicenter of a national debate. But do you feel that, and maybe you know how your dad feels, that if you are holding to religious values, that in the eyes of many in the media, in the establishment, there's something wrong with you? Does that bother you?
No, not at all.
So you're sticking to your religious convictions, as is your dad.
Yes.
What does he tell you?
Yes. what you just said.
Yeah. Are you bitter? Are you angry?
You know, yesterday, I could say probably... Yeah, there was a little anger. And all we can do is pray for them. And truly, we're not really angry at them. We're sad for them. very sad.
Do you have gay friends, Crystal?
No, I don't think so. I know of, down the friend line, yes.
Right. So you have no problem with gays. You just drew the line at having to cater a gay wedding or a gay affair, right?
Correct.
So there are going to be a lot of gays in this country who are listening to you and will probably be catching this interview on the internet and elsewhere. What do you have a message for any of them?
Well, this poor girl, they blindsided her, little town here in Indiana. I think I'll go out and buy a pizza. But here is the problem. Christians see this as they're going to really sacrifice for their beliefs and like that, and they can go a long way towards doing that. But what if that shop was owned by a person who belonged to the Church of the Creator under Matt Hale, or was just a believer in creativity and nature's eternal religion? Do you think she might be out there in the street demonstrating against you? I think she would. Or at least she would go along with the crowd hating your guts. That's the problem we're into today. Now, I'm for total discrimination for whatever reason you want. I think that there are some limits, probably hospitals, where you need to go in and get a treatment, emergency treatment, and so forth. But I believe in a free society is a free society. And you can believe what you want to believe, and you can discriminate for whatever reason you want. And, of course, race included. So, anyhow, that's my position, and I'll stand on that, and I'm going to see whether I can get up to Walkerton to have a pizza. See you tomorrow. Saturn's Day.
We live. We fight. And we die. For each other. Not for you.